Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday Interview Edition. And this week, everyone, you are in for a treat because I know from lurking around Facebook with the Movie Crushers that The Princess Bride is one of the most beloved movies for our listener base. The Crushers love it. I love it. Everybody loves it. I mean, let's be honest here. It's just one of the great, great, lovely, feel-good, sweet, romantic fairy tale movies of all time. And I was really happy that my guest, Molly Coffey, picked The Princess Bride. She's great. Molly is a local production designer who I met a few years ago, everybody, when I naively thought that I was going to go out and make a movie. And I thought I had a little money in place, and I had a script, and I had some actors on board. And I started legit interviewing people and going to locations. And Molly was, her name was passed along to me by my producer as production designer. She said, he's like, you got to meet with Molly. She's great. I met with Molly. She was great. And although that movie did not pan out, obviously, we hit it off. And Molly's just super cool. And we became Facebook friends. And I really, over the past few years, have followed her career via Facebook and just think a lot of what she has to say about the world and about women in the film industry and in society at large. She's just really terrific, and I appreciate her point of view. She's also friends with Raymond and Craig and Karen, who I've had on the show, and Scotty, and just has deep roots here in Atlanta in the film industry, and very talented, very cool lady. So I know you will enjoy it. Here we go with Molly Coffey on The Princess Bride. Where are you from?
I am from South Georgia.
Okay. What part?
This little town called Morven that's outside of Valdosta.
All right.
It's basically a produce stand and a caution light.
Right.
It was very intense growing up.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I didn't have anything in common with anybody around me.
Right.
And I had parents that I, you know, butted heads with. It's funny because, like, my parents were very difficult. And I have one sister who she her reaction to our parents and, like, how difficult they were was to kind of, like, shut down. But my answer was to just, like, constantly fight and be abrasive. And yeah, it was a really crazy, crazy time growing up. So I ended up leaving before, like, I didn't finish high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it running away to join the circus. But then I went to work rigging stages for the Vans Warped Tour.
Oh, wow.
And I was, like, 14. I wasn't even, like, legal to
So you were a carny.
I was. It was it was the best thing that – it saved my life, to be honest. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I was able to find people that I felt were, like, like-minded.
Yeah.
And so I figured out who I was. It's funny going home because I know a lot of people are, like, nostalgic for going home and seeing the people, but I'm not the same person. So it's like, it's really crazy.
Yeah. So you're saying that that small town wasn't full of, like, cool artists in waiting?
No, weirdly not. It wasn't.
So Vans Warped Tour, what year? I mean, I don't know much about the Warped Tour, but what year was that?
That would have been 2000. I mean, no, it would have been 1995.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So back when punk rock was still good.
Okay.
But, man, speaking of punk rock, like, punk rock has not, like, with all the political turmoil that's going on, punk rock is, like, letting us down right now.
I know, because everyone thought this was going to be just what punk rock needed.
I know.
Is it not happening?
No, not at all.
I'm, like, so old and uncool, I have no idea what's good anymore.
There's, like, some weird Hispanic, like, Los Angeles, SoCal stuff going on that's really cool, but
sure.
That's kind of about it.
Nice. Like Morrissey punk cover bands?
Yeah, exactly.
So you realize, like, you were in this small town, and I think you saw the writing on the wall, like, it's almost a literal escape.
Yeah. No, right? It was 100%.
Because you have to get out, otherwise it's all over.
Yeah, I don't think I would have lived through it. I was getting into fights all the time, and I was just really unhappy, and it honestly felt... Like, I felt no connection to anyone. So it was, like, that feeling of isolation and being alone, like, I don't think I would have lived through it if I'd stayed.
I'm always interested when, like, why are you like Why are you? Why are you Molly Coffee? Like, if there were no influence, was there any influence?
Not,
or did you literally strike out on your singular path?
Not really. I mean, there was like a little bit of a punk rock scene in like in Valdosta,
mm-hmm.
and so I definitely was around some people that like punk rock, but it was still like. Like the we just drink ourselves into oblivion,
right.
And we are just kind of angry and misogynistic, mm-hmm. and treat women like crap, but
right.
we don't know what we're angry about. And I was interested. I've always been kind of interested in what motivates people, and so
yeah.
it's funny because our parents they're incredibly conservative and religious, so we uh-huh. were not allowed to watch television at all.
Okay,
so my dad would even. They would keep the television in my parents' room, like just unplugged in the corner. And then on Saturday nights, they would bring the television out, and because my dad wanted to watch Doctor Who, and
so the one cool thing,
yeah. And so, like I had an entire childhood that was basically just Doctor Who, and
wow.
maybe like what movie came on after on Saturday nights, but that was kind of it.
So no movies. In your childhood, kind of, it wasn't a part of your childhood.
No, but my parents allowed us to read anything that we wanted.
Okay.
Like anything. So I was, you know, and I was in the second grade when I read Lord of the Flies.
And, wow.
And I was really obsessed with all the like Harold Schechter serial killer true uh-huh. crime books. And
yeah.
so I was really, I would read, I had a book of witchcraft that had this whole like front half of it that was about the history of witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents were fine with me reading that despite being really
so
religious.
Interesting.
Well, my mom was a elementary school teacher before.
My parents were teachers
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
My so dad was my principal in elementary school. And then my mom taught elementary school at another school.
Yeah.
Yeah. So music was sort of your savior?
It was 100%. Yeah. So I would work for about 4 months out of the year on the Vans Warped Tour, and then I would just jump trains with like the crust punks and
wow.
travel around the yeah.
You're the most interesting person I know.
Well, you know, it that lasted for a time.
Uh-huh. How many years did you do that kind of thing?
Off and on, like 9 years, I
just
guess.
Hopping around the country, huh?
Yeah, and I got really into photography. Like I got a camera, and so I started taking pictures of
mm-hmm.
of like music and stuff, which then kind of led into taking pictures of that was like kind of the insurgence of like the alternative, I guess you call it porn, but it really wasn't. But it was just like tattooed girls wearing like not a lot of clothes and posing.
Right.
And so I kind of got really interested in that because, again, I was really interested in like women and empowering them.
Yeah.
And it felt like this weird part of porn that was like empowering women,
uh-huh.
which I think that eventually I figured out that it's all a ruse. Like,
really?
Yeah, you know, there's crappy people in every
right.
industry.
Exactly. So even if there were empowering,
yeah,
like feelings initially, that was co-opted.
Yeah. Well, like I worked for Suicide Girls and doing photography for them, and it took us a while to figure out that they claimed to be owned by a woman, but it was all just
yeah. What's the deal with them?
Yeah, well, Missy Suicide was supposedly the owner,
uh-huh.
but there was just like a guy like behind the scenes.
Oh.
She was like basically a hired actor, essentially.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, she was involved with the business, but she definitely it was
right.
all just a PR stunt to make it seem like it.
Wow.
And then they decided it seemed really good for a long time, and then they decided that that people were competition. Like some of the girls were getting like bigger than Suicide Girls with
right.
their individual brands. And so then they like retroactively wanted everyone to sign basically like
non-compete or whatever.
Yeah, but it was more like we just have the right at any time to decide something is competition.
Right.
And so a bunch of the girls, there was like a whole wave of people leaving.
Yeah,
like, this was back
so
when there
draconian.
Were like 40 girls.
Yeah.
You know, and now I think they're in the thousands now.
Wow.
Yeah.
So did you work for them or were you just taking pictures freelance?
Just took photos. I was one of their official photographers for a while.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
When did movies kind of start coming into your life?
I was kind of happenstance. I moved to Atlanta in 2005 because
mm-hmm.
I had this internship with a photographer because I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do this for real. Like, I need to quit futzing around and actually
right.
have an apartment and
right.
belongings and things. And so I moved to Atlanta for this internship, and I was on my second day, and he started asking me to, like, wear outfits when I came.
Uh-huh.
Like, and I was like, no, I'm good, thanks.
Right.
And then I showed up the third day, and he's like, no, you have to wear an outfit. And I was like, okay, bye.
Wow.
Thank you. And so then I just
got... So many creeps.
Yeah, there are, man.
Yeah, I know.
So then I just got a job in a bar, and I was working there with these really great friends, and...
Which bar?
I was Raging Burrito in Decatur.
Sure.
I worked there for 7.5 years.
Oh, cool.
It was a long time.
I haven't been there in forever. I don't know why. I used to go there.
Yeah. Well, they have a great patio during nice weather.
It's been a while.
And good margaritas.
So you're working there, and that's when movies sort of started?
Yeah. Well, I started doing these like stop motion movies with my – I met a friend, Chuck Thomas, mm-hmm. who I – do everything with now, but I met him and he had gone to school for film, and we started talking about our love of stop motion, and I was like, well, I can start doing stop motion stuff in my house with all of the equipment that I have.
Uh-huh.
And so we started doing all this stop motion stuff, and I got this guy, this local guy who I was a really big fan of, a movie that he'd made, Mike Bruni, and I asked him to come and do a voice on our on our stop motion stuff. And so at the end of it, I gave him these really cheesy coupons. They were like, hey, I'll come and do free work on your stuff.
That's sweet.
And like 2 weeks later, he called me. He's like, hey, will you come and PA on this music video?
I want to cash in this coupon.
Yep. No, exactly. It took him 2 weeks to do it.
Free back scratch.
It was the best thing I ever did. I get there and I'm like, I don't even make it all the way into the building. Like I'm walking up and there's this girl wearing combat boots with long hair and she's carrying all this really heavy stuff. And I just see all these guys that are like standing around her, and so I go and I start helping her carry stuff, and she was a production designer, and so she absorbed me into the art department, took me on to all these shows, sponsored me into the union.
Coolest department.
Oh yeah, but
it
was crazy because it was like this weird industry where it didn't matter that I didn't have a college diploma or anything, that as long as I worked hard and was pleasant,
absolutely,
I could prosper. And all these weird things that I'd done throughout my life between like working in factories, machine welding, or like even I cross-stitched pillows on The Walking Dead. You know, like
right.
It's like all these weird crafty things that I've done throughout the years like has prepared me for this moment.
Right. So you're essentially had a resume without even knowing it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the cool things about the film business. I mean, I did go to college for 6 years in Athens and had a great time and then went to the film business and didn't do much. But I remember thinking at one point when I was in L.A., I was like, why didn't I graduate high school when I was 18 and move the fuck to L.A. and just start? Because you certainly don't need a college degree. Don't need a high school degree. Like you said, you just need to work hard.
Yeah.
And my career would have been a lot further along, but, you know, you can't retroactively, redo your life.
For sure. Yeah. I love meeting people who are really young and know that they want to work in the film industry because
that's
cool. Crazy to me.
Yeah. Do you impart advice?
I mean, I try to.
Because you're a veteran now.
Sure. The big thing is just that I honestly still 10 years now doing it have to learn is you have to kind of let things organically happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you try to plan out your trajectory and what stuff and what is success to you and compare yourself to other people, this industry doesn't work out that way.
No. The freelance gig is you have to – it's not for everyone.
No.
And you really got to, get your mind right with it.
Yes.
The feast or famine thing and, just when you – I know you know how it is. You think, am I ever going to work again at some point?
Which is probably what I'm going through now. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, are you not working right now?
No. It's 2018 was a crazy year. So I was trying to make a feature film at the end of 2018.
Yeah, let's chat about that.
Okay. So it's called Kaylee Age 8. Mm-hmm. Is this feature film about – it's supposed to be my first feature that I was directing.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be about an 8-year-old girl with autism. And her mom suddenly dies and she doesn't have any other family. And she steals her mom's ashes and goes on an odyssey with this colorful cast of characters to spread her mom's ashes to turn her into a mermaid.
That sounds great.
So
did
it's
you
like
write
a,
it?
I did. Uh-huh. With my friend Chuck that I spoke of earlier.
Uh-huh.
Thank God for him. And so it's something that I've done very publicly, like trying to make this film, because I wanted to break down some of the barriers. Because, we all project success.
Right.
We don't really project, talk about all of our
you
failures.
You mean like on social media?
Is that not real?
Well, I think in the film industry, it's even worse. Like we see other people's successes, and then we have our own struggles, and we're like, how does this person get to make stuff? It's like, no, it wasn't easy for them either.
Yeah, and I remember too. It's all different now. Like they didn't have social media really they didn't have it when I was doing that work.
Yeah,
and so there was all that uncertainty, and you know how it is when everyone's like. You'd start to call people like, are you working? Mm-hmm. Like, is anyone working? But now on social media, it's probably just drives people crazy when you're not working and you see like great day on the set with, you know, I am on this job.
Well, totally. And because even, man, you know, the union, big studio shows that come here are so cyclical in how busy it is and how not busy it is. So like even like everyone, you know, forgets that. Every single year they forget that December and January is really slow.
Yeah.
And so everyone's sitting around, they're not working. They're like, oh, but all this work is coming in January. It's like, yes, 19 shows are coming in January.
Right.
But we have so many union members
right.
that even though there is 19 shows coming, we really need about 60 at one time to employ every single union member in this town.
Holy cow.
So it's, you know, there are a lot of people that are still unemployed. And it's something that people have to, with the influx of work, they forget, I think, or have just joined the union so they don't know. They see it as like this pot of gold.
Right.
And they don't realize how you have to save up money for the winter. And
And then people move from LA and you're like, this is my town.
It is.
Why are you taking my work?
But we should, it's one of those funny things because it comes from just anger of being unemployed,
sure.
You know, and it being hard, but.
Which comes from stress.
It does. But hopefully we are also like getting better at our jobs thanks to some of the people.
Right. No, that's true.
Yeah. Because there are a lot of people that didn't learn their craft before they were able to work on their first show because we just have so much work here.
I know.
A lot of people here need to get better at their craft.
No, I'm with you.
Yeah.
You can say that. What? So where's your movie now? Like, what's the status?
We had a lot of failures. a bunch of our sets were underwater, so that was cool.
Oh, no.
Like, leading up to the whole week, had flash floods leading up to our first day of shooting. I also had some problems with a producer that we're now trying to legally untangle ourselves from.
Okay.
And it sucks because I was trying to be so transparent in our failures for so long and how hard it was. And we have a podcast where we talked about the whole thing.
Oh, yeah?
Like making it, yeah.
What's the name of that?
Well, Atlanta Film Chat's the name of the podcast. Okay. But then we did like a spinoff that was called The Pitch where like for 3 years I've talked about trying to make this movie.
Wow.
But now, because of the legal stuff with the producer, that stuff I can't talk about on the podcast. And that drives me crazy because, like, I legally shouldn't talk about it until all this stuff gets figured out. And there's also a really good chance in the end I'll have to sign a non-disclosure agreement about it anyway.
Right.
But it hurts my soul because, like, my mission is about being transparent. Like, to not be able to talk to everybody about what's going on.
Is this – who's your lead actor? Who's your 8-year-old and now probably 9-year-old?
Well, we had Brooklyn Prince. With Pushing, that's not on the table anymore.
Okay.
So we –
Because of just aging or schedules? And...
She's kind of – she had a television show that she was then going into, and I don't think we would still, after the television show, be able to get her for the price that we were originally going to be able to get her for. But we have a casting agent in L.A. that – actually, after we lost Brooklyn, like told us that she thought that we shouldn't have used Brooklyn anyway. I was like, oh, thanks. But, you know, it's she has all this star power as an 8-year-old, which is hard to find.
What has she been in?
The Florida Project was like the big thing that she got all the attention for.
I can't even with that movie.
I know.
I avoided it for a year and a half just because I knew.
Yeah.
And then finally I watched it. I don't know why, but I watched it on a plane. And I was like, hi, I'm the 46-year-old sobbing mess. And this big burly bear weeping on the aisle seat.
Yep.
Such a great movie. Oh, wow. Yeah. Boy, that would have been a great get.
Yeah, but as the casting director told us that we need to find the girl that our movie is the Florida Project for.
Right.
Like, her narrative for so long was how great she was, and now everybody knows that's not going to be the narrative again.
Right.
So we need to have someone where, like—
Discover your own person.
Yes.
Yeah.
So hopefully, you know, we're— We'll see. We need to have new dates of shooting, which we're currently on you know, uh-huh. gotta get a lot of stuff figured out.
Yeah.
Before we try casting again, we did definitely entertain the idea of using a little girl that had autism, mm-hmm. but as people who we already have a film where we have an 8-year-old girl in every single scene of the film, which
right.
means that we already
That's
can
tough.
Only shoot 7 hours a day, essentially.
Right.
To then introduce someone into that has autism, we would have to, like, bank 10 days that are just, like, a wash, essentially,
yeah.
and we can't afford that.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
I bet you're a great director of children.
I try.
Or a great director, period, but I don't know. I could see you, like, talking, speaking that language.
Well, we, you know, E.T. is, like, the big one that you see,
uh-huh.
like, all the videos of Steven Spielberg talking
yeah,
to Elliot as an adult and talking to him
uh-huh.
and, like, you know, it – yeah, I mean, I really think, you know, we could start getting into, like, art, but, like, art as a whole, especially when it comes to kids,
mm-hmm.
and they're smarter and they understand things and we should trust them with more than we do.
Yeah, that Mr. Rogers theory.
Yep, absolutely.
I remember when I had when I adopted my daughter, John Hodgman is a friend of mine, and he said, the only parenting advice I'll ever give you, he said, is to buy the books of Fred Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, that's all you need. He's like, he understood more than anyone ever.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, child psychology and, like, really the mind of a child. And, of course, that movie.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you talk about bawling.
Yeah.
Ugly
and what
crying.
What a shame upon the Oscars.
Yep.
That is not nominated.
Yeah.
My God, I don't get it. The Oscars is just further proof of what a sham that whole thing is.
Yeah. No women, no women directors.
I know. It's like, I don't know. It's like a half a step forward, 10 steps back, mm-hmm. I feel like. Did you see Eighth Grade, by the way?
No, I didn't. And it played at Atlanta Film Festival. I should have seen it.
It's really, really pretty good.
Yeah.
I didn't see Jonah Hill's. He had a kind of a similar film. Was it mid-90s?
Yeah. Yes. What was it called? I haven't seen it either.
I think
but
it's
I heard that
mid-90s.
Was really good.
Or I might – maybe I'm wrong. But I think it's just sort of a similar thing, like
yes.
kids.
Yeah.
I love movies about kids, like, that are real,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
What were the first jobs that you – like – walk me through your career in the art department. What were your first gigs?
Well, I did a bunch of movies for free, which I, you know, is one of those things a lot of people don't want to do. But it, you know, you just meet as many people as you
yeah.
can. And I just worked really hard. So I did a bunch of stuff with Fake Wood Wallpaper, which
uh-huh.
are local guys. And I just did, three feature films
mm-hmm.
in a row for free, which is an insane amount of work.
Right.
And then Amy sponsored me into the union, and I had my first on-set dresser job at Necessary Roughness.
Oh, okay.
And so on-set dressing, it's the person who's, like, in charge of the continuity, like, on-set.
Right.
Like, as opposed to dressing the sets behind the scenes. And that was the greatest thing that I could have ever done. And I did it for about 3 years. But because you have permission to be on set, you also, as an on-set dresser, get to be by Video Village.
Right.
So it's like film school. Because especially in television, where there's a different director every single episode,
oh, yeah.
you get to watch different directors work with the same
that.
Crew, the
yeah.
same actors. Like,
that's interesting.
Figure out ways to live within a world that like and production rules that exist, but
right.
then find ways to make their mark and find their voice in that. And it was like film school. It was the best thing ever.
Really interesting. So you've probably seen, like, when a director – I never really thought about that. When a director comes in and establishes a show like that, you've probably seen that done really well and very poorly.
Yep, both, for yeah. sure.
What's the best way to do it? Like, just to not try and rewrite everything and not literally rewrite, but rewrite the process?
Well, you know, people deal with trying to be in charge differently
mm-hmm.
is, like, the big thing. A lot of people come in, like, guns blazing, especially a lot of women, because that's the environment that they've been in, that
sure.
they feel like they have to, like, come in and force everyone to respect them, which
yeah.
just doesn't work. And, you know, so you have to come in and – I don't know. There's, like, a way to massage the, like, egos on set to get
mm-hmm.
people to respect you.
Yeah.
Because you also need to be willing to listen to the people that are on the show constantly,
right.
which, you know, some people think that they just know everything. And,
yeah, that's a life skill, though,
yeah.
like, to listen.
Yeah.
And not to come in guns blazing.
But it's funny because some people would do storyboards, others wouldn't. Even this guy, Tim, who directed a bunch of episodes of Twin Peaks, had this, it was just like a piece of lined notebook paper, and it had like stick figures on it, and that was like his version. I was like, okay, like someone who's had the career that he's had, and like this is still what he does.
That's awesome.
It makes you believe a little bit more in your abilities.
And you also worked with Dana and Janet Varney on Stand Against Evil.
That was just announced to be canceled officially.
Oh, no.
I know. Were you
on all of that?
I did all three seasons as a production designer.
Yeah. I mean, they've both been on the show. And, of course, I'm buddies with both of them. I just saw them in San Francisco at Sketchfest. And I remember Dana, when I mentioned you, said, you know, we're all going to be working for her one day. Which I thought, I was like, you're probably right, and that's great. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
And Janet's just the best.
He is. Stand Against Evil is so funny and just how special it was.
Yeah.
Because, again, talking about egos, and Dana's really good at, I think partly because he's very excited about what he's doing, because he's a fan first and, you know, a creator second. But he is really good at using the people around him and their strengths in a way that isn't, you know, like letting people contribute to where we also all feel a level of ownership over what we're doing, which means that we care more and we'll give more. And he gave me a lot of opportunities to contribute to story that as a production designer, I, you know, a lot of times you're just a cog in the machine and it eats your soul. But yeah, he gave us all like this like level of ownership over what we were doing
that's
was
great.
Like really special, which is why we kept coming back.
Yeah.
The pay was pretty terrible.
Yeah. You guys did a lot for a smallish budget.
Yeah. I mean,
pretty impressive.
There were times that we, like, whenever I got the scripts for the third season, there was this kaiju battle, essentially, with an entire town made out of cardboard. And I knew as soon as I got the scripts that Ed, the producer, was going to try to cut it. Like, I knew that that was coming.
Yeah.
So me and my art director, Matt, like made all of these like drawings. We made all these plans of exactly how we could do it.
Because you wanted to do it.
Yeah, I wanted to do it. Are you kidding? Like,
yeah.
And like, so we had to come in with this proposal of this is how we achieve this.
Don't cut it.
Yeah, because we had to figure out how to make it work so that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And you did it.
Yeah, we did.
And I'm sure Dana was super grateful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's really cool. In the second season, there was even an episode that at the end of the season, it was supposed to rain every single day. And we had like 5 days of outdoor shooting. And there was this big demon battle that was supposed to take place outside in the rain. And Dana wanted to put it in this antique shop just because the antique shop was there, which... Mm-hmm. Just was a ton of work for us and also just didn't do anything for the story. And I said, will you give me like overnight to like come up with something different? And the next day I showed up, I had all these drawings and all this about this blanket fort demon baby place that was like a corn maze essentially made out of blankets and baby toys and stuff.
Oh.
And it like added to the story. It was really cheap, way less work actually than like clearing this antique shop. And he immediately came up with this idea for all these cocoons and stuff, but like giving me the opportunity, like the bandwidth to come up with something that made the story better, and then also gave me credit, like has talked about it a bunch about how it was me that came up with it, which he doesn't have to do, you know?
Didn't know that was you.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
That was a great episode.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, Mr. Tinkle Slayland.
Uh-huh. That's so cool. Well, before we move on to Princess Bride, I do want to talk to you a little bit about women in the film industry, because I'm Facebook friends with you, and you always have a lot to say, which is, you're laughing at me now.
No, I'm laughing at myself because of how I am opinionated.
No, but it's great. Like, I think you're a voice I have really grown to respect, even though it's just been through social media, because you're out there, I feel like, as a leader in that area, in this community. And just like, what does that mean to you? And what can you say to young women getting into the field?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We aren't seeing a lot of shift in opportunity for women,
right?
Like, with everything that's changing, we aren't seeing more. Yeah, but and even we see these people that we get really excited. Oh, Ava DuVernay is doing this lab where she's allowing women directors to come to this lab. But the women that get picked for those are the ones that already were about to be TV directors. It's not necessarily creating more opportunity for women. But in all of this, and why the narrative is important, in all of this, the thing that's come out of it is that women believe now that they deserve more and that they should speak out and ask for things.
Right.
You know, you're not going to get anything that you don't apply for. Like,
right.
A man usually only has to be 50% qualified for a job to apply for it. A woman has to be 75% qualified in order to apply for it. Same with, like, women are 70% more likely to have imposter syndrome, that they don't believe that they deserve something if they get it. So the thing that I think is important in all of this is that we believe that we deserve to be there, which is just it's on all of us to continue to be allies to each other and to tell each other that they deserve it and that they should try and go for opportunities. And it's, you know, I've always tried to – women have been really important to me in my life as mentors. And I've always tried to have 50% of my crews always be women, which is hard. Even in art department, you think that it's this creative field, but it's a lot of construction and painting and carrying heavy things. And so it's still a department that's predominantly males.
Yeah.
So women just have to be given opportunities. And I think being an ally, like whether it is to our trans people in our lives or gay people in our lives or, you know, racial, you know, whatever, like people are always going to listen to their peers more than the person that's just speaking out angrily, because that's how, you know, people always argue if someone's speaking out, that they're just this angry person. It's the people that are like side by side with them and friends with them saying, hey man, that's not cool.
Yeah.
That's going to make the most difference in all of this. And yeah, I think we just have to not be complacent.
Right.
And yeah, I think it's on to us for other people to believe in themselves.
What can dudes do?
Just like in a situation, just be sure, one, if you're hiring, that you interview at least, you know, some women. you don't women should always be the best person for the job if you hire them. So I'm not saying to hire more women just because they're women.
Yeah. So go ahead and shut the fuck up if that was your reply.
Right.
Out there.
Yeah, exactly. But give them the opportunity to interview for the jobs.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said, like when someone makes a crappy comment or a racial slur or a gay joke or something, just like be the person that's like, dude,
Yeah.
Nope.
Not cool.
Yeah. It will make a ton of difference.
Yeah. Little changes like that.
Yeah.
Everybody doing their small part.
I was on a set in which a first AD continually would like shush me and talk over me and all this. And we were trying to work out a problem, and I was asking a bunch of questions because I was trying to look out for the homeowner whose home that we were going into.
Sure.
And the first AD basically like put his hand in my face.
Oh my God.
And turned to the key grip and Chris Birdsong, God bless him, turned to the key grip and said, why don't you take care of this for her? And he said, no, man, I think Molly has it.
Yeah.
And that was the first, like, the fact that he told him, like, no.
Yeah.
That was when he finally, like, gave me a little bit of space.
Yeah.
It took someone else, like a dude that he respected, to give me the space.
Which is fucked up, but great that Chris stepped in at least.
Yeah.
I'm pals with these comedians, Cameron Esposito and Rhea Butcher, and they did a show, you probably know all this, where they, I don't know if it was in their contract or if they just demanded that a certain percentage of the crew was female and or LGBTQ. And that was one of the things they were like most proud of in doing their show, which was great. And I think if you're in a position of power like that and you can mandate stuff like that, because it's like you said, it's not like they were like, well, we'll have a C-rate crew that's just full of women that we had to hire. Like they were, I'm sure it was great.
Yeah.
You know?
And the people that are qualified to do those jobs are out there.
Yeah.
And just think of of how inspiring it is to the people, the next generation of people coming up, to see people that look like them or like them in those positions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to make real change. It's just not going to make it quickly.
Right. It is, like Obama used to say, it's like steering that cruise liner an inch in one direction.
Yep.
And in 15 years, it'll be in a much different place.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. You're a sheer delight. The Movie Crushers are, we're preaching to the choir here.
Yeah.
They're a fantastic collection of human beings. But, you know, never hurts to say this stuff. It's not like we're changing minds out there with this listening audience. All right, Princess Bride.
Yeah.
Let's get into this delight. What was your – well, first of all, I usually set it up. 1987, everyone knows this movie. I don't know why I'm bothering. But directed and co-produced by Rob Reiner, starring Cary Elwes, Robin Wright, Mandy Patinkin, Chris Sarandon, Wallace Shawn. I'm laughing reading these names. Andre the Giant and Christopher Guest, who I can't even look at.
I know.
Without laughing.
Oh, my
gosh. And
he's
so serious in this movie, and I still can't not laugh. From the William Goldman novel – He adapted his own book. And it's just one of the all-time classics now.
It is.
When did you first see it?
I honestly am not totally sure. I wouldn't have seen it in the theaters, which it didn't do well in the theaters anyway.
Yeah.
It wasn't until VHS.
Right.
I had a VHS tape that where it had been recorded off of television.
Oh, yeah.
That I would actually keep with me all the time. Because, again, we didn't watch television at my house.
Right.
And I would go over to my friend Belinda's house.
And just bring your tape?
And I would bring my tape and we would
so
watch
sweet.
It. I mean, I have to have seen the film like 300 times.
Yeah.
It's so funny, too, because, like, Buttercup is a terrible female character. So, like, watching it now is really funny. But still, like, it doesn't seem to bother me, but it.
Well, I mean, it is that it's that fairy tale trap, you
it
know,
is.
Where the damsel in distress can only be rescued by the man. It was 1987, and it was sort of stuck to that fairy tale thing. So,
it
is interesting that you're so like, you know.
I know, but I still love it so much.
I know. That's right. It's a small conflict, and Robin Wright is good in this.
She is.
She was just a kid. She was just a BB, 19 years old, I think, when they shot it.
Yeah.
But she and Cary Elwes are just so beautiful, both of them.
And it's so funny even like later listening to her talk about it because she talks about just how cute he was.
Yeah.
And how like pitter-patter her heart was.
Right. Well, I mean, he was not known at the time. And they, of course, cast him because I bought the movie on iTunes or whatever, which that comes with some behind-the-scenes stuff, which is cool. And Rob Reiner was talking about the obvious Douglas Fairbanks Jr., Errol Flynn sort of look that he had, which was perfect for this. But here's the thing. Like, I never had thought Cary Elwes was a great actor, but he's so good in this.
He is. But it's all larger than life, like all of their parts. I mean, but you can't, like, the sword fight. I mean,
Unbelievable.
The amount, like, they did that sword fight.
Oh, yeah.
The only stunt person that was in it was the little flip that he does.
Which was like, so funny. That's such a funny bit. I laugh every time I see that because they, like, basically stop to do these two, like, you know, high bar flips.
Yep.
And let each other do it.
Yep.
And that scene is just, it's one of the best sword fights in movie history.
It is. And it's so funny as a production designer now, like, you study the sets and and like the matte paintings behind them,
so great.
Which adds to the magic of it. But as a kid, I didn't realize that like what it was as
right.
far as sets. But like now, it still like adds. I realize how much that was a part of how the like the fantasy.
Oh,
of
totally.
It. Like if they had gone to a mountain and done it, it wouldn't have felt as magical.
Yeah, which is interesting. And I made a note here. Like they did go on location and. In the UK, and like this movie is part beautiful, real expanses of like the countryside, and then these so obvious stage sets that just add to the fairy tale quality. It doesn't take away, like, it looks corny.
It does.
But in all the perfect ways.
I mean, if you look, you can even see, like, the line. Like, when they're at the bottom of the Cliffs of Insanity, you can see the line where the water is, like, hitting the set, on the back wall.
It's so great. And it's clearly a tank that's, like, just out of the edges of the frame. You can tell there are, like, people standing there. You can sense them. But I love that, especially if you've been on movie sets and stuff. It's kind of an endearing thing, I think.
It is.
And they, to confirm, like Rob Reiner said, they definitely, like every single part of that sword fight, they spent just weeks and weeks training. And it was so important to those two guys to really learn it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you could tell Mandy Patinkin's just still talks so passionately about learning defense for this movie. And it's one of the great sword fights. Really good. So, first of all, Fred Savage is just adorable. He still is. But, like, the cutest kid ever.
He is.
And it hit me last night with Peter Falk. Like, just what a time to be making movies when these legends were still, like, working.
Yes.
Like, some of these original silver screen from the golden age legends where you could cast. And it just seems crazy to think about, like, oh, let's get Peter Falk. Why not? You know?
Yeah.
As grandpa. And I think they even had to age him up a little bit from the looks of it. But the ensemble is just – it's almost like a sideshow or something when you look at everyone. And not just because Andre the Giant. It's just such a weird collection of fringe actors.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at specifically Inigo Montoya, Fezzik, and Vaziri, like the three of them together is absolutely ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
And just – they had these incredible backstories, like, of where they came from.
Oh, really?
And, yeah.
From the book, or?
Yeah, well, yeah. And and they did kind of expand it a little bit, change it a little bit for the, because the book was weirdly dark.
Did you read that?
I did. Like, the book is, it's kind of crazy. It's one of the few that I would say that the movie's actually better than the book.
Oh, yeah.
The big difference, like, that stands out between the book and the, and the movie is, so whenever they go to the pits of despair, it was in the book, it was the zoo of death.
Okay.
And it had five levels. And so he was on the bottom level, and it had all these different animals on the different levels.
Oh, wow.
Where, because Humperdinck was a hunter.
Uh-huh.
And so he would keep all of these animals, like predators, that he could go and hunt. Like, there was one level that had a cloud of bats, and another level that has a bunch of snakes. But whenever Inigo and Fezzik are going down to get him, it takes them, it might have even been weeks, but I know it takes them days to get to him, because they have to go through basically all these, like, beat all these puzzles and stuff to get down and fight all these different animals and kill them to
and
get down to him.
You can't burn up that much screen time.
No. And plus the pits of despair just sounds.
It's all the names in here are so great. It's like a kid wrote it, you know, which is kind of one of the delightful things about it, I think. God, Chris Sarandon is so good.
He is.
And again, he wasn't some big movie star. Like, the casting in this film was just so genius. You know, people like Wallace Shawn. This movie, like, he kind of makes this movie in some ways, even though he had not small part, but he famously leaves about midway through.
Right. But there was with the makeup and the costumes, there was even, like, a plasticness.
Mm-hmm.
Especially to Chris Sarandon's skin was very weird in that movie.
Yeah.
Like, how, like, I don't know. He just doesn't look like a real person, which also makes him a better villain, because you just don't think of him as a real person. Like, he's like a caricature.
Yeah, he and Christopher Guest were so great. And Christopher Guest plays it so straight.
I know.
Which he's apparently like in real life. I've heard he's a very serious guy.
Just funny as a filmmaker.
I know. But, I mean, if you read interviews with him about all his movies, he's all about playing it straight. You know, every single thing he's done, he's always just like, no. Like, that's the comedy in it, is that these dog show people are real, and we're not going to make fun of them, even though it sort of feels like that.
Right.
That's not what he's doing.
Right.
But, yeah, Chris Sarandon's so great. I do want to talk about the that great camera gag when you first meet Andre the Giant, Patinkin, and Wallace Shawn, because I love a good, like, camera laugh.
Right.
And that first shot of them, every time I've seen that, I laugh out loud.
Yep.
Like, genuinely from my gut.
Yep.
And it happened again last night. It's such a funny shot of the three of them because of their sizes.
Yeah.
Andre the Giant is just such a presence.
He is.
Oh. Have you seen that documentary?
Yes.
It's so sad.
It is, yeah. So we here when Rob Reiner's son.
Okay. I don't know who he is.
Anyway, he directed Front Runner. He was directing here in Atlanta. And so he actually did a reading of the Princess Bride screenplay.
And was this the thing he did in L.A.?
Yeah, but he did it here with his cast in Front Runner. So it was like Hugh Jackman and Vera from...
Formiga?
Yeah. Like all... And it was crazy the very first time that like Andre Fezzik comes out, even on that, everyone... Like, it got really emotional.
So you went?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Where was it? Plaza?
No, it was at someplace downtown. It was a very fancy place, weirdly enough.
Was like this Jason Reitman?
Jason Reitman. There
okay.
you go.
Okay. So he did this at LACMA in 2011. And he does these a lot, like these staged readings with different people. And he had, for this one, he had Paul Rudd as Wesley. Mindy Kaling is Buttercup, which...
didn't he have, like, Donald Glover was in it?
He did not have Donald Glover in this one. He had Patton Oswalt as, was it Vizzini? Oh, that Vizzini. Was... Yeah, that's Wallace Shawn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kevin Pollak as Miracle Max. And then he had Cary Elwes as Humperdinck, which I think was a nice
That's really funny.
Yeah, nice little turn. He actually had him there. And then he had Rob Reiner do the grandfather role, and Fred Savage actually came and reprised his role as the little kid. But he does these readings a lot for movies, and I've always just been like, man, how do I get into that?
Well, when they did it here, it was for money for Puerto Rico.
Oh,
like
cool.
All the money went to charity.
How great was it?
I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And it was crazy because we freaked out about it, and we got like six tickets to it, and then Hugh Jackman, like there weren't very many tickets being sold, and then Hugh Jackman like tweeted that he was going to be there, and then
and
it
so who
sold
did
out
he play?
In like 15 minutes. He was Wesley.
Oh, okay. And who did the Andre the Giant role?
I don't remember.
But that was a sad moment.
It was like yes.
Just because everyone was had all the feels about the whole thing.
Yeah, like how do you not?
Yeah, yeah. He was. I mean, I highly recommend that documentary to anyone who hasn't seen it. He was, by all accounts, a very good guy and the gentle giant that he was known to be. And even in that behind-the-scenes thing I was watching last night, he was talking about how the world doesn't accommodate big either. He's like, big and small. And he's like, we're both sort of in the same boat, weirdly.
In the behind-the-scenes, did Rob talk about how he had to, like, because they couldn't understand how he was delivering the lines, Rob actually recorded all of the dialogue onto tape, and Andre would listen to it, and basically, so he was kind of just performing phonetically what Rob had recorded, like, how to deliver the lines.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
He talked about what good instincts he had, though, just as a performer in wrestling, and he just said he was so... honest, because he was untrained, you know, quote unquote untrained as an actor, that he just said all his instincts were just so pure every time. I know. It's just like, I don't want to cry.
It's funny for such a physical movie how many people were injured on that, because Andre's back was messed up.
Yeah.
So they had to like kind of fake all of the stuff where Wesley's like on his back. And then Wesley broke his toe during.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so like whenever he rolls down the hill and they're having the whole like, as you wish. But at the bottom of the hill, whenever they have their conversation about like he like sits down on a log and then stands back up, and you can see him like he has his leg out and he's like lifting himself up with his arms because he was like favoring, because he had just broken his toe and he tried to hide it for a long
time.
Oh,
like he pushed through the scene?
Yeah.
Wow.
But he didn't break it during the screening. He broke it. Andre had this little cart that, because he couldn't even fit in the van for everyone to go from set back.
Oh my God.
So they had like basically like a golf cart that was just for Andre. And I guess Cary was driving it with him, and I don't know if they wrecked it or something, but he broke his toe.
That scene, since you brought it up, the roll down the hill, like there's so many great dumb gags.
Yes.
And I say that like I think dumb jokes are the best thing in the world. And that just kills me every time when she just shoves him. It's just such a like I mean, who thinks of something like that? I guess it's Rob Reiner.
Yeah.
And then she just like pitches herself.
Just pitches herself. It's like there are way easier ways to do this. Come on.
It was so great. And then all the, you know, the clearly like post-recorded ADR of them just going, ugh, oh. And it sounds so phony. It's just so great.
They just needed a Wilhelm scream.
Right. That's all they needed. I'm surprised they didn't do that, actually. And that physical comedy gag got me. And then the last, whatever, 20 minutes of that movie with Cary Elwes completely limp.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, they just milked so much comedy out of that silly gag.
Yeah. But man, the best part, though, is my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, yeah.
It's like one of the classic lines. He said that, and this ends up with so many quotable lines, but Mandy Patinkin was talking about how just that has followed him his whole career. And he didn't get it the time. He just kept looking at the script going, I really say that a lot. But you don't know it's going to be an iconic film or line.
Well, yeah. But some of the stuff that we even quote the most is even just the
– What are yours?
Well, even you know, there'll be rocks ahead. If there are, we'll all be dead. Right. Stop rhyming. I mean it. Anybody want a peanut?
And
then obviously the inconceivable. You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means.
Yeah. He says that people still to this day, if he's out in public and like drops his keys, someone will – and picks him up, someone will go, inconceivable. So great. Emily, my wife, hers is always if something happens where – just one of those couple things that's just super embarrassing that only your partner sees. She'll just go, marriage.
That blessed arrangement.
Like, what's up with that? Such a, again, these weird, weird choices.
I know. Yeah, totally weird choice.
Like, where did that come from, I wonder? Mm-hmm. Surely that wasn't in the script.
No.
I wonder if Peter Cook just came up with that.
Right. Yeah, no. Because, yeah, it totally wouldn't have fit into the book, that's for sure.
But it just makes that scene, you know? They could have played it straight, I guess, but why would you have Peter Cook in your movie and not have him do a funny accent?
Oh, that's another big difference between the book and the movie was whenever they are at Miracle Max and he's going to make that big, that obnoxiously large magic pill.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They have to go on a quest to find the ingredients in the book to bring
that's
them
whole
back.
Thing.
So, yeah, so there's a lot of time passes in the book that.
Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with Billy Crystal. Because my brother worked with him and he was like not the nicest guy in the world. So I've always let that kind of color my opinion. But I love When Harry Met Sally a lot. And I think that's like one of the legit great romantic comedies of all time. And he's just so funny in this. He and Carol Kane. It's just great.
And practically all of that was ad lib.
Yeah. They just let him go, huh?
Yeah. He never did the same line twice.
Really?
Ever. Yeah. Like the mutton, it was totally him.
MLT.
Yep.
They were the behind the scenes again. They were talking about during those scenes that Rob Reiner would just have to just consistently leave the set because he couldn't keep himself from laughing and ruining takes. So wonderful. Some of my favorite lines, too. And there are a lot of good band names. I always joke about on stuff you should know about band names. Rodents of Unusual Size, great band name.
I don't believe they exist.
Unemployed in Greenland, I think, would be a great band
unemployed
name.
Unemployed in Greenland. See, that's why I know that that he has like a weird – he was really self-conscious about the fact that they wanted Danny DeVito in that role.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so it's something
because
that he took
the
through the
gag?
Whole film. Yeah, he took through the whole film that he was – self-conscious the entire time because he knew that they didn't want him.
Huh.
But who could have, like, it's classic.
Oh, he's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the scene, you know, the very, very famous now scene of the wine and the poison. I can't imagine. I mean, I love Danny DeVito.
Right.
Dearly, but that is Wallace Shawn 100%.
Yeah.
No one else could have done that.
It wouldn't have been the same, that's for sure.
Yeah. That's such a great scene. I would love to – I've never, like, printed out that section of dialogue and read it out loud. I bet it's pretty great just to read and to remember all that too.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah.
Cary Elwes is great in that scene too. I think he's kind of the unsung hero of this movie in some ways.
Even with his stupid mustache.
Yeah, that thing was – Emily was remarking about that last night. But I think part of the thing with the sets that we were talking about looking kind of phony at times, that has weirdly allowed it to not age, I think. There's something about it looking fake and make-believe that makes it timeless in some ways.
Yeah. Well, whenever he jumps headfirst into the lightning sand, even as a production designer, I still don't understand why the sand doesn't fall when they open the gate for him to fall. Like, I still don't understand how they did that.
Yeah.
And he wasn't originally supposed to, like, he was supposed to just jump in feet first, but he said it wasn't heroic. And so he jumped in, he wanted to jump in head first, so they had a stunt guy come in and try it, and then he was fine. And so then Carrie did it, and the first take, and that was the one that they kept.
It looked great.
Yeah. But I don't understand, because if you have a trap door and you have, like, the mattresses and foam and stuff on the bottom, the pads on the bottom, I don't understand why the sand didn't fall through when they opened the trap door. It drives me crazy.
So they've stumped you as a production designer, like how they do that?
Yeah.
Do you know who was the production designer on this?
I don't. I should.
Interesting. That might be the kind of thing where you could find out, Molly.
I know.
Get in touch.
Yeah.
Here's another one of my favorite lines that I think doesn't get enough attention is Chris Sarandon's, "Please consider me as an alternative to suicide." It's just such a funny line. And then when he's being tortured on the machine, what's the machine called? Do you remember?
It's just called the machine.
Oh, is it really?
Yep.
When he cranks it all the way up and just the whole valley, like, hears that wail, Montoya says, "That is the sound of ultimate suffering."
I also love whenever Wesley knocks Fezzik out, he says, "Dream of large women."
Oh, that's right. What was that all about? Such a random line. So great. And, you know, everyone in that behind the scenes was just all these years later just talked about what a – they knew at the time. They didn't know it was going to be a cult classic, but just what a special experience and how much fun they had, and what a gentle, collaborative hand Rob Reiner was as the guide, which is really cool to know.
Yeah, it is. It's magic. And that's why we want to make movies, is because there is a magic to it. But could you – I mean, if this movie had come out now, we wouldn't have any patience for the kind of lo-fi-ness of so many parts of it. Yeah.
It would be all CG'd out.
Ugh.
This is one of those that I would literally write a strongly lettered, worded letter if they ever talked about remaking
this.
Oh,
my gosh. No, they can't.
You just can't do
it.
They
can't.
But I've said that before.
Ugh.
And they do it.
I know. And I it's funny, in the past couple of years, I've tried to come back around to remakes because I used to be such a snob about the idea of them. And,
same.
And I'm like, okay, you know, the old movies don't negate, like the new movies don't negate the fact that your movie exists. And there are new generations and movies mean things to different people. And the thing that really actually got me was the female Ghostbusters movie.
Oh.
That movie, I know, like the Ghostbusters fans, like, hated it and got really upset by it. But, I mean, you can watch videos online of these little girls, like, in their little – with their little proton packs, like, getting, you know, their signatures. And whenever you get to the final battle with Holtzman, I'm just, like, bawling, crying when I saw it in theaters. And it just –
Stuff like that is important.
It is.
It's bigger than movies, for sure.
So I try – to have an open mind about remakes and reboots and man.
I think it's great, though, when they will remake something with a different race as the lead role or gender. And it gets so much shit online, though.
I
mean, that if you're sitting around reading Ain't It Cool message boards or Reddit message boards on this stuff, like – there's so many more valuable things to do.
There are. And we should be able to enjoy things for the sake of enjoying things.
Yeah. I like that Ghostbusters movie. I thought it was good.
Yeah. It was really important to me. And Paul Feig actually mailed me a poster. Because I have a t-shirt that says female Ghostbusters are the best Ghostbusters.
Uh-huh.
And Rob Cohen was the director on season 3 of Standing as Evil, and I wore it one day because we had gotten into an argument about Ghostbusters. And he took a picture of my shirt and he sent it to Paul because they're friends.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
So then Paul mailed me a poster with like this inscription that was basically like, thank you. I'm so glad that our movie meant something to you.
Oh, we
appreciate
that's
it.
That's sweet.
I know.
That's really great.
It did mean something to me, though. I have a Holtzman necklace, the screw you necklace. I wear it all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, here's my dirty secret, and this will upset a lot of people that are listening. I don't think the original Ghostbusters is some untouchable titan of comedy.
Yeah.
I loved it. I'm not even going to say that. I liked it, and I still like it, but I don't think it's like the funniest movie ever made. I think some of the Bill Murray stuff's funny, and I enjoyed it when I was a kid, but I don't hold it up as this like sacrosanct, untouchable thing.
I think I think it's just really special to some people because there was, again, you know, seeing different kind of characters as the heroes at the time. It was special to a lot of people. We'll see what now they've announced that the new movie's being, the third film is being made. Yeah.
Oh, the third regular cast?
Yep. They're finally making it, supposedly.
Who's in? Do you know?
I don't, but it's supposed to be a lot of the original cast.
Are they going to merge with the reboot?
No, they're going to pretend like the girls didn't happen.
Huh. What's his name was so good in the reboot?
Hemsworth. Oh, Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah,
oh,
really
my
funny.
God.
He was great. Let me see. What else do I have on here? Oh, your perfect ears. I thought that was one of the funny lines that goes a little unsung. And wallowing in freakish misery. It seems like such a fun script to sit down and write because you could do whatever. Like nothing was off base.
Yeah.
You'd be as silly as you wanted to be as William Goldman, weirdly.
But yeah, the drama in delivering those lines.
It
was just crazy how good it was.
Yeah. And the ending is just so sweet. That last bit, you know, with the thread running throughout the story of, because you kind of forget at times that Grandpa's reading to cute little
Fred Savage.
Yeah. When he says that great line, since the invention of kisses, it's just so romantic. Even if you're like cold and dead inside, it's hard not to kind of believe in that a little bit.
Supposedly there is like an alternate ending that was shot where Fred Savage goes to look out the window and they're on the horses and he like waves at them.
Oh.
But
I
guess we'll never
that.
See it.
Because that would have been cool.
Yeah, it would have. But I kind of do like the idea of it like being like that it exists as this tale in this book.
Right.
That then that the grandson and the grandfather then tomorrow when they read the book again get to go on the adventure again.
Yeah.
So you keep it contained to the story.
I get that.
Yeah.
Just so, I mean, it was so funny and romantic and sweet, but it was just also they managed to honor fairy tales while poking fun at fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting little magic trick they did there.
Yeah, nothing in it is like anything else, which is like the weird part about it.
Yeah.
The characters and their relationships to each other and how strange they all were. There's just nothing else like it.
Yeah. And it's a movie, too, where it is timeless and will never go away. Because just last night I was like, all right, Ruby's 3.5. I was like, when can she see this?
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon.
Yeah.
In the next couple of years, I think.
Maybe you could just skip the machine part if you really.
Machine and maybe the rats would scare her a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it's like that she will grow up with it. And then if she has kids, we'll show it to her kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those movies, you know, is going to live forever. Kind of like Goonies.
Yes. Oh, Goonies.
Goonies never die. I didn't even mean that. Play on words. I can't wait for someone to pick Goonies.
Yeah.
And I tried to get Sean Astin in here when he was in town. Emily still has a crush on him.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and he's one of those people that, from what I hear, is just so nice.
Yeah.
That, like, it's, you know, it's hard meeting. Like, working in the film industry, sometimes it's hard meeting people that
it's a risk.
You're a fan of.
I know. Don't ever meet your heroes.
Nope.
When it works out, though, it's pretty great.
It is.
But when it doesn't, it's crushing.
It is. Yep.
Have you been crushed?
I have a couple of times.
Do you want to talk about it?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No, probably not.
Fair enough.
But yeah, no, I have a couple of times. And it more it's less, obviously you always have the people that just treat everyone really poorly, which that almost doesn't quite bother me because, I don't know, I feel like when you grow up in this entertainment industry where you have these people that are constantly tending to your needs, it just, you exist in this bubble that's like not healthy. Like,
it's not the real world.
You look at people like the Vampire Diaries and stuff like that, where these people from like 16 to 25 were on this TV show. Like, these are years that are integral to who you are as a human being, to then have just people waiting on you hand and foot. And I'm not saying that they're like terrible people. I just worry for who they become, you know, because of like existing in this microcosm.
Yeah.
So like just kind of being crappy isn't that bad. It's when you then find out that they're like misogynistic or homophobic or then they make really off color jokes and stuff and comments, and then you're
huge
like
huge disappointment.
Yeah, because we exist in a liberal
industry.
Yeah. And so it also just bothers me that people let them think that that was okay to talk like that and act like that.
Yeah, long enough to where they just are comfortable like that.
Yeah. Someone pointed out to me the other day, like, people talk about the liberal Californians coming to town, you know, when we talk about this religious liberty bill here in Georgia and what's happening. And someone pointed out, and I'd never really thought about it, is like, I think that part of the reason that the film industry is so liberal, quote unquote, is because we are based in unions, and in unions, your rates are set by the union, like how much we're getting paid. So no matter if you're a guy or a girl or gay or black or whatever, we all get paid the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's almost like we have this base set up.
Right.
For like everyone to be treated equally, and like that's like sets this weird like tone for everything else of like why we're so liberal in our points of view.
Socialist.
I know. Oh, I definitely.
Well, it's funny. I was just thinking though about that the treatment of actors and stuff. You know, I was a PA for many years and worked in art department some, and then had the smallest little taste when Stuff You Should Know was on TV for a year, and on set, I always had the urge to, like, when I heard the walkie go off, to, like somebody needs to get the trash. And I would go to the trash can, and it would be, like, that PA, like, DNA was still in me. But I even – and this was among friends with Raymond and Craig and Karen and everyone. Like, you get treated different. And, like, I didn't like it. And I saw how it could be just abused. And this was on this tiny little Science Channel show.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine being some big star where just you can – get anything you want at any time and hold up the production if you don't want to be on set. Like,
which those are the big ones. And there's a little bit of a need to keep the talent separate from the crew just because the talent has got to perform and they've got to be able to perform the same over and over again and get into their performance immediately upon getting to set. And things can become disruptive to that if you're interacting with the crew and whatnot. So it somewhat makes sense in that regard of like keeping them separate. And I've worked on a couple of like $100 million films, and there are some funky things that start happening between like some of the, like one of the actresses found out that the actor had better, like his place was better than hers. And so then she wanted her place to be moved.
Yeah.
And then the guy found out that she had like different snacks in her.
Oh my God.
I mean, it was like this just going back and forth back and forth. It was just crazy.
Yeah.
But like that wasn't about her being a girl or him being a guy. It was the agent had negotiated differently. Like, that's on the agent, not them.
Yeah, and I've also seen on set where when we had someone really high profile coming in for, like, a one-day thing, and everyone is scared, and you have all of these things like, oh, they've got to have, you know, wash their hair with Evian, and you got to have all this, and you got to have all this. And then they show up, and they're fine. And it is the agents and managers that are really overdoing it. And they show up and they're cool and they're like, oh, no, it's no big deal. You can just wash my hair with regular tap water.
I was told one time not to look Terrence Howard in the eyes. And then later we were talking and like I told him that they had said that. And he's like, what? What is that?
Yeah, I know. I always used to hear that about Prince when he was in the room. No one could look at him. And I bet you that wasn't true.
Yeah. As a little bit of the writers, I think, well, from the rock star point of view, was that if they couldn't meet those like if they couldn't meet the things that they wanted, then they didn't want them to do the show because it meant that they
right.
weren't a good venue.
That's like the Van Halen Eminem thing.
I don't know if that translates at all to the film industry.
Maybe.
Probably a little bit. I mean, yeah. You do have a lot of trust, you know, when you sign on to do a show, as you know, you walk onto the set with these strangers as to what you're getting yourself into, and you hope your safety is being taken seriously first most.
Yeah.
But then also you hope that it's a professionally run, good film. Because, like, you know, you talk about Midnight Rider, and, you know, we have, friends that were on that, and it was a terrible situation, like, across the board. And a lot of people that were very much in the wrong in that situation.
Yeah.
But and everyone now has an opinion about it that, oh, well, I wouldn't have let them do that, and I wouldn't have agreed to this and that. And it's easy to say that, but you, as a crew member, you have a lot of trust that everyone around you has done their job and has taken care of you. And we don't ever know what we would have done in a situation.
Yeah, because everyone has been on the jobs where they can look back and say, man, that was so dangerous.
Yeah, I've done some stupid stuff just because we didn't have any time to do it right.
It's all about time.
Yep.
And for those of you listening that don't know what we're talking about, Midnight Rider was the Greg Allman biopic that shot here in Georgia that very sadly a camera assistant was killed by a train. And I know it made national news, but if that's what we were talking about.
Yeah.
So sad. And I know a lot of positive change came out of that. But, like, it shouldn't take a young woman losing her life, you know?
No, just
so sad.
Not.
You got anything else on Princess Bride?
I don't think so. It's just a magical film.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out if I've definitely seen it more times than Star Wars, which is kind of crazy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You can actually count?
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, we finished, Molly, with five questions.
Okay.
What's the first movie you remember seeing in the theater?
It
I guess you were 25 years old.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been until much, much, much later. Oh, gosh. I would say, yeah, oh, my God. It might even be as late as, like, Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh, wow.
I know, that's how late it was. I just didn't see things in the theater.
Yeah.
It wasn't an option.
All right. First R-rated movie?
Oh, that I ever saw. This is going to be really bad. But it was this terrible horror film called Dr. Giggles. It was the first horror movie that I ever saw.
I don't think I've even heard of that.
Oh, no, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible horror film. But because it was my first horror film, absolutely terrified me.
Sure.
Yeah, and which is funny because now I live and breathe horror movies.
Right, right.
But that just goes to show all these parents that want to, like, keep their kids in a protective bubble.
Doesn't
like,
work.
They're going to like what they like, I hate to tell you.
So many great horror movies now. It's such a great time.
There is.
You know?
Horror, more than anything, is taking chances on telling stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw the trailer the other day for the new Us.
Jordan Peele's new movie.
Oh, my God. And I can, like, handle horror, but that looks fucking terrifying.
Also, how is it that we know so little about that film? You know what I mean?
Know.
Like, in this day
it.
And age.
So cool. What a great idea. Will you walk out of a bad movie?
I have when I was younger. I wouldn't now, I don't think.
Okay.
I think that it is very hard to make movies.
It is.
And I think everyone deserves a participation trophy just for completing a film.
Yep.
So I wouldn't now. I did when I was younger, but no.
Yeah.
No way.
You've been in the trenches now.
I have. It's hard to make movies.
Yeah.
And there's so many circumstances that are out of our control. Like, you really have to get lucky to complete a film.
Yeah. Like, you're almost surprised when movies do get completed, if you've ever worked on one.
Yeah. And not even on an indie scale. Even, you know, how the big movies, like, how many times they just money falls through, things happen.
Yeah.
You know, very often we'll work on films that they've set up the production office. We're 3 weeks into production and then they've pre-production and then they've lost the main actor and then the film is folded.
Right. And you never hear about it.
Nope.
Number four, I tailor to the guest. So I'm going to ask you, or how about this? What's your, do you have a favorite art direction in a film?
Yes, definitely. Let me say for television, because television in particular recently with Legion, the TV show.
Haven't seen
it. Or Maniac, the TV show.
Oh, I saw Maniac.
There's this crazy mid-century modern thing happening with these really over-the-top creative. Uh-huh. You should definitely watch Legion. Legion is insane.
Really?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Maniac was so weird and great.
Yes. But like that, there's so much that's happening in television. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel has some of the best art direction
so
I've ever
great.
Seen.
What a beautiful show.
Yep. But as far as movies, I'm like, this is going to sound crazy, but I might actually say Gone with the Wind is my favorite art direction.
Wow.
But again, it's those matte paintings of the backgrounds, and it's just, again, like this larger than life kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I've seen Gone with the Wind quite a few times, too.
Yeah. I mean, it's a throwback. And you know Karen Fried, right?
Mm-hmm.
Karen came in and talked about Rebecca, the Alfred Hitchcock film, and it's so fun to go back and look at these movies where all the old tricks are on display, you know?
Yeah.
Matte paintings and just real cameras moving through space, and it's pretty great.
Back when people did stunts, like,
unsafely. Right, right.
Just crazy.
And then finally, Movie Going 101, what's your deal at the movie theater? Where do you sit? Do you get anything to eat or drink?
I always have Cherry Coke and then a small popcorn.
Okay.
That's what I always have. No candy really anymore because I'm chubby. It's just a way of life.
Yeah.
I always sit in the – so they have the front. The front is always – there's always like the line for the front section and the back section. And I'm always right behind the second row of the back section. So it's kind of in the middle.
All right.
But it's I guess, right in front of the middle is where I always sit. But it's because I don't want too much stuff happening in front of me.
Right.
That then is like a distraction from watching the film. If people are talking their movie, they better be sitting behind me.
Right. Because you can't shoot daggers behind you.
Right. You know. Well, you can kind of tune them out. It's like out of sight, out of mind. But yeah, if it's happening in front of me, I have been known to...
To shush?
To get in
good
conversations with people in the theater.
Yeah.
I actually had a boyfriend break up with me because I got into an argument with a lady in a movie theater, and he said that I embarrassed him.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, hit the road, buddy.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, if that's what you're worried about, as someone who, like, drinks a lot of whiskey and has you know, yeah. If that, best you get out now.
All right. Thanks, Molly. This is great.
No, thank you for having me.
All right. All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that. I should mention that very sweetly afterward, Molly gave me a gift, everyone. She's the first guest that actually brought me a little thank you gift, and it was a collection of like buttons and stickers and a very lovely card that she wrote. And it was just really speaks to what kind of person Molly is. She's wonderful, and great things will just continue to happen in her career. I'm sure at some point, someday, you will see a Molly Coffee production on a big screen near you. I have no doubt that that'll happen. So I hope you enjoyed our chat about The Princess Bride. A great, great movie. It was a lot of fun talking to her about it. And that's about it. So... And until next time, maybe you should just unsubscribe and stop listening to Movie Crush. But that's inconceivable! Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at HowStuffWorks Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.